You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat Satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyin min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu rabbiyyuna kathir. Fama wahanu lima أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا رافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا حسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Israeli forces continue to violate the Gaza ceasefire deal, with Hamas killing more women and children in fresh strikes across the war-torn territory. Palestinian officials say Israeli forces have abducted 21,000 civilians in the occupied West Bank since the Gaza genocide started in October 2023. And an Israeli report has highlighted the regime's failure to provide physical defenses to its critical sites in the face of Iranian strikes in June. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story: Israeli forces continue to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement nearly 2 months after its conclusion, killing and injuring more civilians across the war-ravaged territory. According to local sources, two civilians, including a child, were killed and at least 15 others injured after Israeli artillery fire targeted a house in the Al-Tufa neighborhood of Gaza City. Two more civilians, including a child, were killed, and over 20 others, mostly women and children, injured in artillery shelling of Al-Sanafur area and Al-Daraj school, east of Gaza City. The school was used as a shelter for displaced people. Gaza's health ministry said the territory's hospitals received 5 bodies on Tuesday, increasing the number of Palestinian civilians killed since the enforcement of the truce to about 360. Among those killed was a Palestinian photojournalist who lost his life in a drone strike on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another journalist was wounded in the same attack. Since October 2023, the Israeli genocide has claimed the lives of over 70,100 Palestinians, leaving nearly 171,000 others injured. Qada Ibrahim is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments from the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime continues to violate the ceasefire and has not halted its ethnic cleansing and genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. Ada.
Yes, on the ground, the Israeli violations of the ceasefire deal are continuous, actually, since day one of this deal until now. And in the past couple of days, the Israeli occupation army has escalated its attacks on Khan Yunis city and also on the eastern bars of At-Tufah and Ash-Sha'af areas in the eastern bars of Gaza City. In the past 24 hours, at least 5 Palestinians were killed in different attacks. The first was in Khan Yunis city. The Israeli occupation army targeted and shelled with artillery fire and artillery shells the eastern bars or the areas that happened to be behind the so-called yellow line, and that resulted in 2 martyrs. One of them is actually a photojournalist, Mahmoud Wadi, and he was killed directly as a result of the attack. This again highlights how the Israeli occupation army is again targeting the Palestinians, is again killing the Palestinians, who are actually posing no threat to the Israeli forces. However, in order to continue and to press ahead in their genocidal attacks and in their ethnic cleansing on the Palestinian people. Again, in the eastern parts of Gaza City as well, the Israeli occupation army and the Israeli artillery targeted a sheltering school in Ash-Sha'af area near As-Sanafur area, and that resulted in 2 martyrs and many injuries, and many families in this sheltering school were actually besieged as a result of the Israeli fire, as a result of the attacks. And the Israeli occupation army kept targeting the ambulances that were trying to evacuate the people and the families who were actually besieged under the Israeli fire in these areas in the eastern parts of Gaza City. Since the early hours of the morning until now, the artillery shelling is continuous behind the so-called yellow line on the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City in particular, on the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah as well, and also on the eastern parts of Gaza City like Al-Sha'af and Al-Tufah neighborhoods. To the north of the strip, the Israeli artillery and the Israeli fire are continuous actually towards the people's homes and shelters in the north of Jabalia and the north of Beit Lahia areas. This again highlights how the Israeli occupation army is continuous actually, is attacking everyone trying to cross the yellow line and also attacking the Palestinians by widening the so-called yellow line areas. And again, most of the population and most of the people are crossing the yellow line without knowing the real demarcation or the on-the-ground demarcation of the yellow line. This actually is very ominous for the Palestinians. Many people and many families have no options rather than staying in their areas and staying in their homes. However, the Israeli attacks are continuous. Since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement until this moment, at least 360 Palestinians were killed as a result of these violations and these attacks. At least 900 Palestinians were injured, and that actually is reflected in the hospitals of the Gaza Strip. The hospitals are already overwhelmed since the beginning of the Israeli genocide, and nowadays there is no relief, actually. The Israeli occupation army keeps targeting the people, keeps attacking their families in the eastern parts of the city, and many injuries are arriving to the hospitals of the Gaza Strip. Again, the hospitals are still overwhelmed in the midst of the shortages they are living, they are experiencing nowadays. No medical supplies are allowed until this moment. The Israeli restrictions on the medical supplies and on aid are continuous, as the Israeli occupation regime is not adhering to the humanitarian protocol agreed upon in the ceasefire deal. So the Israeli violations of the ceasefire deal are costing the Palestinians their lives, and are causing bloodshed on one hand, and also suffocating the population and causing more deprivation and more starvation and more humanitarian deterioration in the humanitarian crisis for the population. Many families are still living the starvation that started with the start of the genocide. Many families, they don't have access to any food, and they don't have access to medical care nowadays in the Gaza Strip because of the Israeli restrictions and because of the Israeli policy of depriving the population and suffocating them.
All right, thanks a lot, Ghada Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. A new report by Palestinian officials in Gaza has revealed that the Israeli regime is waging a bloody war against media workers in parallel to the genocide of Palestinian civilians. According to Gaza's government media office, the regime's forces have so far killed hundreds of journalists to prevent unbiased coverage of their crimes in the war-torn territory. The office noted that during 2 years of their Gaza aggression, Israeli forces have killed 257 media workers. It emphasized that the regime's forces have been targeting journalists in a systematic manner, condemning the deliberate assassinations of Palestinian journalists. The office called on the International Federation of Journalists, the Federation of Arab Journalists, and other global media institutions to take a clear stance on the regime's crimes. It also held Israel and its Western backers, topped by the United States, fully responsible for the crimes committed against journalists in Gaza. The office called for urgent international efforts to mount pressure on the regime and stop its attacks on media workers in Gaza. Journalist and political commentator Sakina Datu believes that the killing of journalists is part of the Israeli regime's strategy to prevent truthful reporting on the Gaza genocide.
The strategy is quite clear, really. It is about making sure that the truth does not come out, because apart from, you know, killing the internal journalists, Israel has not allowed international journalists or media to be present over there. And from the day one, this was because they do not want anything that they do, the massive killings, the inhumane treatment of Palestinians that we are watching because of these very journalists who are being killed. They want to hide the truth. So 257 journalists killed in Gaza. So it tells you that there is a real strategic way over here to kill the story, as we would say. And that is because the story is that of their brutality. These journalists, a lot of them who have paid the highest price by, you know, being killed, they are the ones who the entire world really should be grateful to, because had it not been for them, none of us would have really realized what happened in the past 2 years. Today, you can see globally, there is an awakening. Even though the bombings are not stopping, killing is not stopping, but Israel is hated so much around the world, and there is an imploding from within. Even within Israel itself, it is imploding. There, all this has become possible only because these journalists in Gaza have put the truth or the reality of what they are facing ahead of even their own lives. It's really commendable, and I think...
Israeli forces press ahead with violent raids on different Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank. In one of the latest incursions, the regime troops arrested a number of Palestinians in the Qabatiya neighborhood south of Jenin. In the occupied city of Al-Quds, occupation forces stormed the Kafr Arab neighborhood. A refugee camp in the city of Al-Bira was also raided by Israeli troops. There are reports that the Israeli military withdrew from the city of Tubas after days of aggression and siege. Also on Tuesday, several Palestinians were killed by the IOF in the West Bank. Political analyst Robert Fantina says Israel continues committing crimes in the occupied West Bank, knowing that it's immune from accountability due to Washington's support for Tel Aviv.
The West Bank was under siege for years. It's been under occupation for years. But this increase in arrests is just beyond anything that's been done before. Now, the Israeli government is arresting anyone it sees, and of course it arrests people without charge. It can hold them indefinitely, again without charge, without granting them access to legal advice or to families, and holds them in horrendous conditions. Even the Israeli Supreme Court has said that some of those prisons have awful conditions, but the rest of the world certainly says it. So this is Israel once again knowing it can get away with anything it wants to. It's immune from accountability because of the U.S. veto in the United Nations mainly. But again, it's demonstrating itself as a criminal regime, a racist, brutal, and completely lacking in justice or respect for human rights or international law. The Israeli forces are trying to intimidate the Palestinians in the West Bank to let them know that any resistance whatsoever, however minor, can result in the arrest and destruction of their homes. It's an intimidation tactic which they've used in the past and are accelerating now. But again, it just demonstrates the lack of morality and the obscenity of the Israeli regime.
Day three of a court hearing between the direct action group Palestine Action and the British government has been held in London's High Court. Palestine Action is challenging the government's banning of the group earlier this year, a move widely criticized as an overreach and an infringement on the right to protest. Said Putaza has the latest.
Today is the third and final day of that judicial review in this court. It's in fact a legal challenge brought by the direct action group Palestine Action against its prescription by the Labour government in July this year. Last month, the judges heard from the representatives of the Palestine Action group. But today, the final day, the judges are hearing from lawyers representing the Interior Ministry, known to Britons as the Home Office. But here is how we got here.
Set up in 2020, Palestine Action's stated goal is to end global participation in Israel's genocidal and apartheid regime. It's mainly targeted weapons factory, especially those belonging to the Israeli group Elbit Systems. In July this year, activists protesting against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza broke into an Air Force base in southern England, causing, the government claims, more than $9 million in damage to two aircraft. Days later, then Home Secretary Yvette Cooper declared the group a terrorist entity, effectively making membership or support for the group a criminal offense. The ban took effect in July 5th.
It's a massive, massive overreaction and, frankly, an act of state repression to stop the people from mobilizing in a way that they feel is detrimental to their financial interests.
Seeing this as an attack on their civil liberties, thousands have since come out in a string of rallies, holding up signs reading these words. At least 2,300 have been arrested, more than 200 charged with offenses that carry up to 6 months in prison. Earlier this year, Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, requested and won permission for a judicial review of the ban at this court, for the court to see if the ban was lawful if the Home Office followed the correct procedure before proceeding to proscribe the group. In October, the government tried and failed to block the challenge going ahead. And last month, after days of nationwide sign-holding protests, the judicial review finally began. But at the last minute, Martin Chamberlain, the judge due to hear the legal challenge, was replaced by a panel of three judges without explanation. Two of those replacement judges have links that campaigners say raise the appearance of a conflict of interest.
The case against some of the most formidable foes in the world, the British state, the Israeli state, the weapons industry, these are not people who are going to take this lightly. So it doesn't surprise me that they're willing to sabotage the process.
Dame Victoria, who has familial links to prominent pro-Israel lobbyist and major Labor Party donor Trevor Chin, and the group Quilliam, which has been widely condemned as Islamophobic and for supporting far-right agitator Tommy Robinson, and Justice Jonathan Swift, who dismissed WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange's extradition appeal back in 2023, has represented the Home Office, which is the defendant in this judicial review, on more than one occasion.
A judgment is expected at a later date, but if the judges in this court find in favor of Palestine Action, the group could potentially be deprescribed. The charges against its many supporters will have to be dropped, and not only that, it'll be a huge embarrassment for the British government that the pro-Palestine demonstrators in the country accuse of participation in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Saipur is up London.
A report from within the Tel Aviv regime reveals that Israel's interception and protective apparatus was susceptible to Iran's retaliatory strikes in June. The report by the regime's official comptroller says that some critical Israeli sites were struck by Iranian ballistic missiles. Matanyahu Engelman named some of the facilities that suffered damage. They include Beersheba's medical center, the Haifa Bazan oil refinery, and Rehovot's Wiseman Institute of Science. He blasted the regime's Ministry of Military Affairs and the IOF for failing to provide physical defenses for the critical infrastructure sites. Engelman said they received damage despite repeated warnings dating back to 2011 and a detailed 2020 report highlighting the structure's vulnerabilities. Israel launched an unprovoked war on Iran on June 13th. Iranian armed forces managed to swiftly respond to the regime's acts of aggression by carrying out missile and drone attacks. Multiple analysts and different reports have confirmed so far that Israel has tried to hide the scale of the damage its critical sites received in the 12-day war. Iran, Russia, and China have formally informed the UN Security Council that all provisions of Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2015 nuclear agreement, have ended in October 2025. They emphasize that triggering of the resolution's so-called snapback mechanism by Western states is therefore devoid of any legal basis. The three countries made the comments in a joint letter to the UN chief and the Security Council's president. They stress that the snapback mechanism cannot be applied without completing the dispute resolution mechanism embedded in the nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. They argued that the United States' 2018 withdrawal from the deal fundamentally altered the mechanism. Also, the European Troika's unilateral restrictions against Iran and failure to meet their commitments have invalidated their claims about Iran's noncompliance, reaffirming that all provisions of Resolution 2231 have expired on October 18th. Iran, Russia, and China said the Security Council must close Iran's nuclear file. The UN Secretary General's report on Resolution 2231 is set to be presented on December 13th.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Silence, a man was burning. and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence, a man was burning and keeping the light.
Ocean of Dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and all of you who are listening to RIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Ocean of Dua. And this program, we try to discuss the different concepts and meanings and try to interpret the passages of different supplications that have been issued by the Ma'sumin, peace be upon them. we were continuing the discussion on the supplication of Sabah, Dua al-Sabah. And let's listen to one passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back and we'll talk more about that passage.
Ya man dalla ala dhatihi bi dhatihi wa tanazzaha an mujanasati makhluqati wa jalla an mulaamati kayfiyati. يا من قرب من خطرات الظنون وبعد عن لحظات العيون وعلم بما كان قبل أن يكون.
The passage that we just listened to from the supplication of Sabah reads, وَجَلَّ عَنْ مُلَاءَمَةِ كَيْفِيَّاتِهِ. It has been translated as, and Allah is exalted beyond conformity with his qualities. So we just can't imagine how Allah is, his qualities. His qualities are in a way that we can't just put one single entity that we can describe and say that that is Allah. It's beyond our thoughts. It's beyond our intellect. Okay? So, Jalla is very similar to Tanazzaha. Except Jalla means he's higher. He's higher than being described of the things that we think, the human thinks. Allah's qualities are beyond our intellect. The next passage of this supplication reads, يَا مَنْ قَرُبَ مِنْ خَطَرَاتِ الظُّنُونَ. O he who is near to the passing thoughts of opinions. Again, we have this problem with the translation that the words, they don't match each other in English, whereas in Arabic, they are perfectly matching. خطرات الظنون. This is an Arabic collocation that is best understood in Arabic. It means things that cross our minds, that pass. Okay? And it's saying that Allah is really close to us. Okay? When we think about Him, when we have thoughts, when we think about Allah, He is really close to us. We have in the Quran, Allah says in Surah Qaf, وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ وَنَعْلَمُ مَا تُوَسْوِسُ بِهِ نَفْسُهُ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلِ الْوَرِيدِ. So Allah knows exactly what goes on in our minds, even the slightest temptation, even the slightest thought that we have of something. Allah knows about it. And in fact, He is closer to us than our jugular vein, based on that verse. And this passage of the dua is quite similar to that verse of the Quran. Ya man qaruba. Qaruba means who's near. Min khatarati dhunun. The passing thoughts of opinions. So nothing is hidden from Allah. That is how Allah encompasses the entire universe. We're not saying that Allah physically encompasses the universe, as in He is present physically everywhere, but He knows, He has knowledge of everything as if He is present in that moment. So if we just have a slight temptation, for example, we think about something that is not right, like we think about a specific sin, but we don't really entertain it too much. It's a passing thought. Allah even knows that passing thought. Okay, let's listen to the next passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back.
O O he who is near to the passing thoughts of opinions, far from the regards of eyes, and knows what will be before it comes to be.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
You're listening to RIB English Radio, and you just listened to another passage of the Supplication of Sabah, where the Ma'asum says, وَبَعُدَ عَنْ لَحَظَاتِ الْعُيُونِ. It's the exact opposite of the previous passage. بَعُدَ means he's far. Of course, بَعُدَ itself is a verb. But in English, we don't have such a concept which we can just fit it into a single verb. We have to say, he is distanced, he is far, he is far. وَبَعُدَ عَنْ لَحَظَاتِ الْعُيُونِ. He's far from the regards of eyes. Now here, this passage means physical eyes, okay? Because eye means something by which we can see, okay? Allah also has eyes, but it's not physical. We have in our narrations that the 12th Imam is Aynullah Nadhira. He is the seeing eye of Allah. That means he sees all of our deeds. Just like Allah sees our deeds, he sees the deeds of all human beings. Because he's the Imam. لا تدركه الأبصار وهو يدرك الأبصار وهو اللطيف الخبير. So, the eyes, the physical eyes, can't see Allah because Allah is not visible, is not a physical entity to be seen by the physical eyes. وَهُوَ يُدْرِكُ الْأَبْصَارِ. But he can see us. He can even see our eyes. Okay? So, this means that, like we said, جَلَّهُ عَمْ مُلَاءَمَةِ كَيْفِيَاتِهِ. He is too high to be physically seen. Because if we say that Allah is a physical being, we are limiting him. We are saying that he is confined to a specific place or location. And Allah is Jalla. He is exalted. Tanazzaha. He transcends. He is clear of such descriptions and attributions. And that's it for this episode of the program, The Ocean of Dua. I leave you in the care and mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
wife.
A little over a year since Milei's taking office as president of the Argentine Republic.
Milei, este país se encuentra en una situación.
This country is facing a situation that's truly a social disaster, a national catastrophe, and a near total loss of sovereignty and independence.
Prácticamente absoluta de la soberanía y la independencia del país. Todos los lineamientos.
All economic policies have led to the destruction of small and medium-sized industries.
De la pequeña y mediana industria. La sustitución.
The replacement of domestic manufacturing with imports has resulted in a significant increase in unemployment, reaching levels that surpass what was historically seen in Argentina before.
Incluso superan lo que ya era histórico en Argentina anteriormente. El pueblo se ha salido a la calle reiteradas veces.
The people have taken to the streets repeatedly, demanding the continuation of social programs in education, health, and housing, where there is a clear and visible regression.
Los jubilados particularmente han perdido.
Retirees in particular have lost nearly half of their purchasing power. They have seen reductions in benefits for medications, health care, and more. Everything is being privatized. Everything is handed over to the market. However, the market has only resulted in the extreme enrichment of the Argentine oligarchy, and even more so of the international imperialist oligarchy. The International Monetary Fund tightens its grip around Argentina's neck and thrives on the misery of the impoverished neighborhoods. American imperialism dictates Argentina's international policy alongside the Zionist entity that occupies Palestinian lands. In fact, Javier Milei openly identifies as a staunch Zionist, and of course he stands here as a servant. Allowing Zionist companies to take control of numerous Argentine businesses, even in the territories occupied by England, such as the Falkland Islands. Javier Milei does not support sovereignty, independence, or social rights. Argentina is truly on the verge of losing its autonomy. The country is searching for a way out, and its people are seeking a solution. What will this combination of popular social mobilization look like? Will an Argentinazo coincide with electoral participation?
Participación electoral cuando son llamadas estas, todo está por verse, pero lo que sí está claro.
Everything remains to be seen, but what is clear is that Milei and his anti-patriotism, along with his submission to Zionism and imperialism, have only brought about injustice and inequality, exacerbating the existing issues. Therefore, all forms of struggle are laid out for the Argentine people.
Esperamos de todo corazón.
We sincerely hope they find a way out of this dilemma. Without a doubt, they will succeed. The Argentine people have historically shown signs and examples of dignity and standing on their own two feet. This time will be no different. We await it with all our hearts. This is Black and White. I am Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes.
The progress of Washington's policies for Latin America has manifested in a unique way in the Republic of Argentina. Among the harsh elements, we see an economy that is driving the most vulnerable sectors, such as retirees and the elderly, into misery. There is a sense of destruction of the national industry, and with a president who seems to be out of touch, meaning not in his right mind, we find ourselves in a situation where we want to understand where this is heading. What is the way out? What is happening? How are the trials going, for instance, with the case of, regarding the former president, Cristina Fernandez, among others? How does the Argentine people perceive this? To discuss this right now, we're joined from the Republic of Argentina by Yair Sibyl, an analyst and journalist from the Argentine media outlet El Grito del Sur and the radio station Madres. Welcome, Yair, to Black and White.
Hola, Eduardo.
Hello, Eduardo. Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation.
Yair, en la presentación...
Yair, at the first section of this program, I tried to address some topics about what's happening today in Argentina. Where is Argentina headed? After all, this issue is a concern for Latin America, and I would say on a global level, because it seems that one of the most profound neoliberal attempts is currently underway.
Well, in Argentina, we are currently facing a very concerning situation, especially regarding political and economic matters. The government of Javier Milei, which promised to dollarize, close the central bank, and turn Argentina into a powerhouse, is instead retracting consumption on one hand while implementing extremely high interest rates and opening up imports on the other. This is fundamentally affecting the Argentine industrial structure, leading to business closures and a financialized economy. As you rightly mentioned at the beginning, Eduardo, the ones suffering the most are the most marginalized sectors, retirees, people with disabilities, public universities, and those working in the informal economy. Today, we are witnessing that the dollar, which was the anchor for him at the macroeconomic level, is skyrocketing. A society that had faith in Javier Milei, deeply disappointed with the previous Peronist government, is now starting to distance itself just a year and a half into his administration, especially with important elections on the horizon that could shape the future. All of this is overshadowed by a serious corruption case involving overpricing for medications intended for people with disabilities, which was charged by the president's sister, a person he trusts the most. In other words, while Javier Milei himself was cutting pensions, his sister was charging drugstores a 3% surcharge to finance, well, the organizational structure of La Libertad Avanza.
That's right. This is related to, for example, the cryptocurrency scandal, right? The Libra crypto.
Absolutely. It's not just the Libra case, which you rightly pointed out, and that lacked the urgency one would expect from the justice system, but also a bribery scandal involving PAMI, the agency responsible for serving retirees and pensioners. Additionally, there was a scandal involving suitcases that entered the country without being inspected, linked to someone very close to a businessman associated with the government. We also have the sale of candidacy by Javier Milei and a series of corruption events that undermine the notion that this government was here to fight against the political elite and bad practices. Instead, it appears they are on one hand plundering the country's resources and handing them over to large multinational corporations, and on the other hand, enriching themselves personally, particularly the government leadership with Javier Milei and Karina Milei, currently at the forefront of this situation.
Javier y Karina Milei.
Así es. Ahora, desde un punto de vista de las fuerzas políticas.
That's right. Now, from the perspective of the political forces that oppose Javier Milei, one could observe a very broad spectrum, right? From those who aim to work towards a strong Argentina to be able to vote for it, to the participation or lawfare of which Cristina Fernandez is currently a victim, regardless of one's opinion about her government, right? But it is a reality.
Absolutely. Well, the situation with Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is quite clear because it happens with all popular leaders in Latin America. It occurred with Lula da Silva. It happened with Rafael Correa. It happened with Evo Morales. And it has happened with the major leaders who are capable of truly transforming reality. Cristina is not imprisoned due to a corruption case, as her name isn't even mentioned in a highly flawed case. Instead, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is incarcerated because she represents the main alternative power to Javier Milei. During her administration, for instance, the AFJP, the private pension administrators, were nationalized. 51% of YPF was nationalized. Aerolíneas Argentinas was nationalized, and a significant portion of income was democratized. I believe there are figures that explain why Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is in prison. At the end of 2015, when she left office, the minimum wage was over $500. Today, the minimum wage is $150. Therefore, this is also a strategy of the dominant class in this country.
That's right. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. We're here with Yair Sibyl from the Republic of Argentina. Yair, you were discussing the factors that influence the Argentine justice system, which has undoubtedly been manipulated by Milei himself to implement the well-known house arrest of Cristina Fernandez.
Yes, and I'll add something else, Eduardo. I think the most serious thing isn't the 6 years in prison, but the content of this sentence, the perpetual ban from holding public office. Obviously, from my perspective, I understand that the great transformative process in Latin America, from Bolivar and San Martin and O'Higgins to the present, have always required great Cuadillo-like leaderships that can overrule the interests of the ruling classes in Latin America. Cristina actually represents this, and that's why the sentence has to do not only with the 6 years of house arrest, but more worryingly with the perpetual ban from holding public office. And it doesn't come at any random moment. It comes just weeks after Cristina announced that she would run for representative in the province of Buenos Aires. So what we have to look at here are two things. On one hand, the attempt by the right wing, concentrated in the judiciary, to decapitate the main political opposition, which is Peronism. And on another hand, a certain rearrangement of Peronism that has its historical leadership, its main leader, imprisoned and unable to be a candidate for the 2027 elections.
Yair, we are facing a scenario of repression, even affecting retirees. We have serious social issues, including the removal of a significant number of social benefits. How is this felt today in the Argentine community? What is the reaction? In fact, today I learned that there were quite strong protests against Javier Milei, who had to practically flee from a visit to an area. What is the way out? What do we see? The upcoming elections are indeed on the horizon, but from the perspective of popular mobilization.
Well, you mentioned a very important fact, Eduardo. A few days ago, Javier Milei was in Lomas de Zamora, in a popular party historically governed by Peronism, and after many years of tweeting leftists are going to run, his candidate ended up running, right? He had to escape on a motorcycle, basically because of the popular outcry he's generating 2 days after it became known that he overcharged for medications for people with disabilities. And I also think your question is pertinent in terms of considering an institutional solution. On the one hand, elections must necessarily be won in this country, and I think in that sense, Peronism has a large number of supporters because it has exercised power, I mean, with very virtuous lines like those of Nestor and Cristina Kirchner. But on the other hand, it's also important to make visible that the streets are expressing a lot of social conflict. The retirees' marches, the protests in defense of the Garrahan Children's Hospital, the massive mobilization of public universities, they're also expressing a certain discontent among the people, which doesn't necessarily result in an electoral opposition, right? The reality here is that many other people who voted for Milei aren't far right or extremely libertarian, but rather a depoliticized vote that was disappointed with the last Peronist government, with the government of Alberto Fernandez, which basically flouted all the principles of Peronism because it appealed to dialogue and consensus rather than confrontation with the ruling classes of this country. I think part of the crisis of political representation we're experiencing in Argentina, the emergence of the right, can be explained by grassroots movements that betrayed their campaign promises, that appealed to moderation and dialogue, and ultimately ended up perpetuating the status quo. Take, for example, Alvaro Garcia Linera, and think about what happened in Bolivia. Well, much of that interpretation also applies to Argentina, and I think a very small sector of Peronism, but one that has the capacity to cause harm, bears a great responsibility there. It managed to influence the majority sector, which is the one that lines up behind Cristina Kirchner, to lead a government down the path of dialogue and consensus. Let's hope that in the reconfiguration implied by Milei, Peronism can find more consistent, more combative, or more sovereign alternatives to oppose the national project proposed by Javier Milei.
Now, Milei has clearly aligned himself with the United States, particularly with Donald Trump. He really seems like a Trump surrogate. Some even suggest that he might be an agent of the Mossad. A few journalists have even gone so far as to say that. How does this feel from the perspective of Argentina's sovereignty?
De Argentina.
Well, it's terrible, Eduardo, to bring this up. Javier Milei was the only president-elect who visited Israel this year and took a photo with Benjamin Netanyahu. This shows the level of alignment he has with the interests of the United States and Israel, and above all, the seriousness of this. Argentina's main sovereign claim is the occupation of almost a quarter of our territory by the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and NATO. Argentina is a country that should evidently be at the antipodes of any American, British, or Israeli interest, which are the same geopolitical interests internationally. And paradoxically, Javier Milei appears to be the main supporter of Donald Trump and his expansionist policy, but not of his economic policy, because he would like Milei to protect national industry, strengthen tariffs, and prioritize Argentine production over foreign production. But that's not the case, and the most worrying thing is this. While Israel has never recognized Argentine sovereignty over the Falkland Islands and the South Atlantic Islands, the entire vast and diverse Arab world has always supported Argentina's claim. Therefore, even Javier Milei's radical right-wing ideologization undermines the interests of our country, whose main conflict is with the United Kingdom of Great Britain, which incidentally also seeks to control access to Antarctica, something that will be rediscussed in 2048, and which, of course, we should be discussing together with Chile to think about a South American Antarctica, but with NATO expelled from our territory.
Pero echando a la OTAN de nuestro territorio.
Así es.
That's right. Recently, explorations have begun and oil platforms have been set up in the Falklands, a joint English-Israeli venture, right? On another note, a company from Israel has also taken over the distribution of drinking water in Buenos Aires. Now, how does this feel on the political front? Because, of course, there is a new American ambassador who has proposed some action lines. What's his name? He has urged people to vote for the candidates of Milei. He has also called on governors to avoid any kind of relationship with China. How is it that an ambassador is intervening so openly for the first time in such a brutal way in Argentine politics?
Absolutely. This isn't the first time he's done it. Remember that General Juan Domingo Perón's first campaign was Braden or Perón. In other words, Braden was the U.S. ambassador at the time, and the opposition campaigned. Although Braden wasn't running for office, the Perónist campaign was between Perón and the U.S. ambassador. Well, this Peter Laimlos is a new Braden. He's a guy who wants to intervene in what happens in Argentina, especially to align it geopolitically with the United States and distance it from the BRICS. Remember that before Javier Milei's arrival, Argentina was about to join the BRICS, which would have been a qualitative leap in our strategic relations framework. But you also pointed out, Eduardo, something I think is important to highlight, which has to do with the U.S. presence. The head of the Southern Command recently visited us again, and this has a very clear mission, to strengthen the U.S. presence in our region. You mentioned Navitas, the Israeli company that explores and will extract oil from our Falkland Islands. And you also mentioned Mekorot, the Israeli-owned company, which is most worrying. It has control of drinking water exploitation in almost 13 provinces of our country, 13 out of 24, to give you an idea, in the simple majority of our provinces. I think this is very worrying and shows how, on the one hand, Zionism and its structures permeate Argentina, which is a strong point in the region, and on the other hand, how our country is a very relevant country, the eighth largest in the world, the country with the longest uninterrupted presence in Antarctica, a country that has been a symbol of third worldism during the years of Perón, Néstor, and Cristina, and how it is a highly coveted asset for the United States at a time when the other three most powerful governments in Latin America, and I'm talking about Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, have a center-left alignment. One can offer criticism and nuances about some of these governments, but they are not aligned with the United States. So the United States clings to a figure like Javier Milei, who is its guide in the region and its guarantee of being able to act as a counterweight to Mexican Sheinbaum, Brazilian Lula, and Colombian Petro.
That's right. However, Milei did not implement any form of state strengthening. Yet the state's intervention in the economy is clear, especially with the recent agreement with the IMF, which we all understand the implications of. Elaborate on that, please, in a minute.
En un minuto.
Absolutely. Well, Milei was something else during his campaign. During his campaign, Milei promised he would dollarize our salaries. Ask me, Eduardo, if we are earning in dollars. And I'll tell you that sadly not yet, or at least our peso hasn't appreciated to the dollar. He also promised he would close the central bank, and the central bank continues to intervene in the economy. And the state is still present, but it's a state that favors the rich. While taxes are being lifted on luxury cars, pensions, and retirement benefits for the most vulnerable sectors of our society are being cut. We'll see if the Argentine people are willing to condemn him at the polls in this next phase, or if the street struggle manages to advance the necessary leadership that can put a stop to this government.
Muchas gracias, Yair.
Thank you very much, Yair, for your time and best wishes for the Argentine people.
Thank you, Eduardo.
Thank you. challenge of suffer and my worry kindles my mind. Challenge.